Surgeon Ben Carson leads Donald Trump for the first time in Iowa, and Hillary Clinton is back on top among likely Democratic caucus goers. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, a view of the 2016 race from a Christian college in northwest Iowa, and a week of wildfires in that part of the state. Details of a clever Iowa prison escape on July 4th. An Ames company creates 48 million doses of its new bird flu vaccine. And why the town of Swisher is expected to vote down Johnson County's minimum wage ordinance. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, Iowa State Penitentiary Warden Nick Ludwig released a review into the escape of a convicted armed robber from his cell in the maximum security A-pod of the penitentiary. If you remember, that was an escape that took place on July 4th. The Associated Press requested the review under the open records law. Ryan Foley, in fact, of the Associated Press did that. He's a correspondent for the AP in Iowa City and joins me now. Hi, Ryan.
Hello.
Remind us of exactly what happened. This is a fascinating escape. Ingenious. July 4th, the escapee Justin Kestner.
Yeah, Justin Kestner was housed in a maximum security cell known as the A-pod. And unlike the other cells, this has its own shower because these are some of the most dangerous inmates, so they want to keep them away from other inmates and staff as much as possible. Well, Kestner was able to he realized that there were screws that were loose on his shower, and he was able to pull off the access cover, and he kind of was able to discover the inside walls of the prison. There was this very narrow, what's known as a pipe chase, that he was able to climb up to the attic of this building, climbed through the attic and emerged through a vent and ended up on top of the roof of the building and was able to climb down the downspout and escape.
With the help of a rope made out of bed sheets.
Yeah, the review found that he actually didn't use the rope. That he had 77 feet of rope, which would have been almost enough to get him to the ground.
This is a four-story structure.
Yeah, yeah. And but instead, he apparently opted to climb down the downspout instead.
Mm-hmm. And he did end up escaping. For how long was he at large?
He was at large for, I believe, about 12 hours or so. What he did was he went on foot for about 5 miles up to the town of Weaver, and he was able to steal a car from there. And he took off. Looks like he went up to eventually got on Interstate 80 in Iowa, went over to Illinois, and eventually he ditched the car. I believe it might have run out of gas. And soon an Illinois state trooper caught up with him and arrested him.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting. He also timed it so that the guards would be, he hoped, and it happened to be true, distracted by 4th of July fireworks in Fort Madison.
Yeah, so he had practiced this for several days. He found this that he could do this on June 28th, apparently, and he had been practicing for several days. And thought,
made a dummy to go in his bed, a la Escape from Alcatraz?
Yep, made a dummy out of milk cartons and insulation and bed sheets. And he'd apparently in the middle of the night, he'd go and practice. And when they captured him, he had bruises on his torso and his legs that he said were from his numerous test runs.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was at the Fort Madison Penitentiary just a few days ago with Warden Nick Ludwig. And I'm sure you know, his house, the warden's house, is literally right next to the walls of the old fort. And he made a comment as we were standing, looking at this very wall about this escape. He said, you know it's a bad day as a warden when you get up and walk into work and you see bed sheets hanging from your prison. The warden with a good sense of humor about this escape, obviously. So, Ryan, what did the review uncover as far as errors?
Yeah, so the review found some policy and procedural errors, and including that there was a lack of timely rounds by the guards. They're supposed to make rounds every 30 minutes, and perhaps that didn't happen in the days and leading up to the escape and the escape itself. He was also critical of their failure to keep an accurate inventory of all the property that he had in his cell. But the union president says this was just a cunning individual and a unique set of circumstances. And, he alleges the guards made their rounds, but they were fooled by the dummy.
Now, this took place at the old fort, the old facility dating back to the 1800s, parts of the facility, the new Iowa State Penitentiary, a quantum leap forward in terms of security. Do you think the systems in place, the security systems to prevent escape, solve this sort of problem?
Yeah, by all accounts, this was kind of a freak, one-in-a-million incident, it seems like. And the new, very, very high-tech new prison probably won't see an escape, anything like this at all.
Okay. Ryan Foley, AP correspondent in Iowa City. Prison, among other things you cover, but I understand you're also looking at another prison incident that happened more recently in Anamosa?
Yeah. Federal prosecutors announced earlier this month that four former tower guards at the prison were facing a number of different charges, including possessing firearms while being unlawful drug users. This all centers from an investigation that uncovered that some guards were smuggling cell phones inside the prison to inmates in exchange for money, and also smuggling drugs inside that were allegedly traded among the guards themselves. But at this point, there was no evidence that the drugs got to the inmates.
Okay. We'll look forward to that report, Ryan Foley, as you covered. AP correspondent in Iowa City, Ryan Foley, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. An Iowa company has developed a vaccine for bird flu. The Ames-based Harris Vaccines announced it developed a vaccine over the summer to fight this highly pathogenic avian influenza. And it has contracted to provide 48 million doses to the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service. We're joined now by Dr. Hank Harris. He's president and CEO of Harris Vaccines. Hello, Dr. Harris.
Hello.
Dr. Harris, this has been approved by the USDA. Was that problematic at all?
No. The approval process went very smoothly, and we're really appreciative of the USDA for moving it along quickly. We received the approval in September for a conditional license and then made application for the stockpile vaccine by the government, and that was placed on order here just recently in October.
Mm-hmm. Now, this vaccine will be used in the fight against bird flu. This is the disease that wiped out about half of Iowa's egg-laying hens earlier this year, right?
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you know when or how it might be used in the future?
Well, as I said, we received an order from the government, which called to produce a stockpile of the vaccine, these 48 million doses, and so once those are produced, they come under control by the USDA, and then the USDA will determine if and when the vaccine is actually released for use.
Mm-hmm. And you would have to inoculate, immunize every single bird?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, by injection.
I guess that's a challenge in itself, isn't it?
Yes, that's right, because there are many birds in the U.S.
What does this mean for your company, Harris Vaccines?
Well, it's quite a landmark for us because we've never actually produced this many doses of a vaccine. Two or three years ago, we, of course, had the vaccine for the PED virus for pigs, and that allowed us to expand our facilities and prepare us to make large amounts of vaccine. But this is the biggest order we've ever had, for sure.
Mm, a contract, I understand, worth some $6 million to provide these 48 million doses, including 25 million within 40, 5 days. Now, in producing that, are you involved in that? Can tell us about the challenges of producing so many doses so quickly?
Well, we've got a really good team, and we have, people that are full-time in manufacturing, but we also have a good research and development team. So certainly for the first few weeks here, we've pulled in everybody from the company to participate. Even my assistant's been helping the lab some. So, but we're off and running. We're in full production. We were in full production beginning on Monday, and things are going very well.
Do you have a count as the number of million that you have done already, doses?
Well, we made close to 1 million doses on Monday, right?
On one day?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do these vaccines stockpile well? Do they have a long shelf life?
Yes. Well, with our technology, we can stockpile in bulk form, particularly for at least 2 years. So. So we'll be prepared for another call if that's necessary. The government indicated they may call for more vaccine every quarter. And
right.
So we should be in good position to make more vaccine if a need is there.
Does this vaccine then assure us that that will not be repeated, the disease wiping out half of or more of Iowa's egg-laying hens?
Well, it depends on that's a tough question because it's a big decision by the government whether to actually use vaccine or whether to try to use various methods of biosecurity and so forth to decrease the severity of the disease. So we'll just have to experience that if the disease occurs. If vaccine is used, experimental results certainly indicate that it will decrease the number of birds that die from the disease.
Mm-hmm. Is there any downside to using a vaccine when faced with this kind of epidemic?
Well, in a country that has been free of this particular virus, could have a big impact on trade. And so countries that have been receiving poultry products from the United States tend to restrict trade and so forth. And that trade can be restricted not only due to the occurrence of the virus, but it could also be restricted because the vaccine is used.
Mm.
So that's one reason that the government wants to control its use when and if it's used.
Okay. Dr. Hank Harris, president and CEO of Harris Vaccines. They were just awarded a contract to provide 48 million doses to the USDA of a newly developed vaccine to fight the highly pathogenic avian influenza. Dr. Harris, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
It's your News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. A new Johnson County ordinance will raise the local minimum wage from $7.25 an hour in 95-cent increments, and this incremental rise would reach $10.10 by 2017. The first phase starts in a couple of weeks, unless cities, towns in Johnson County vote otherwise. The town of Swisher in Johnson County, that's just to the north of Iowa City, looks set to do just that. It's expected to vote down Johnson County's minimum wage ordinance. Joining us to talk about the debate and the situation in Swisher over raising the minimum wage is Mary Gudenkopf. She is a city council member for Swisher and also a high school career advisor in Swisher. Hello, Mary.
Hello.
Also with us in our Ames studio, Peter Erasm. He is a university professor of economics at Iowa State University. Welcome back to our program, Peter.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start with you, Mary. Since Swisher looks to opt out, where is the city council on this move at this point?
So as you mentioned, Swisher sits right in the smack dab in the middle of Iowa City and Cedar Rapids. We're exit 10 off of 380. And our small town has a population of roughly under 1,000. So in preparation for this, we surveyed our business community, which amounts to about a dozen businesses in our little city. And we had 9 people respond to that survey. And roughly 100 people or so are employed in our city. And of those 100, there's about 5 who are working minimum wage jobs. So that's the population that we looked at in getting to our decision.
Okay, so it would affect really only 5.
That's the data that I have from the responses that we have.
Okay, based on the responses there. And you are voting no to raise the minimum wage as part of the city council. Now, where are you in this vote? Has the council come down on the no side?
We did. And although we will have a second, that is the only agenda item we have on Monday night in a special meeting in Swisher. So initially we had a 4-1 vote against raising the minimum wage. And, you know, from my perspective, I need to sit at the city council table and represent the interests of the community in which I live in. And in attendance at that particular meeting a week and a half ago were some business owners who spoke to the impact this would have on their businesses if a minimum wage increase were to take effect in Swisher.
Any adults there at those meetings speaking up for the minimum wage?
Absolutely, yes.
Yep,
there were counterparts from Johnson, representing Johnson County, who were in attendance as well.
From Swisher?
From Iowa City.
Oh, from Iowa City. Okay, traveling
correct.
Up to Swisher. Okay.
Right.
Peter.
We had very good point counterpoint.
Okay. Peter, give us the broader view here. You actually looked at this, the research you've done on the impact of Iowa's minimum wage some years ago in the Journal of Labor Research. But what can you tell us about the impact here of Johnson County's ordinance to raise the minimum wage and allowing communities to opt out, such as Swisher seems to be doing?
Well, Iowa City, probably the minimum wage isn't going to have a large effect. Certainly the first, I think they were going to add these in increments of 75 cents apiece. Currently, the median wage in Iowa City is roughly $18 an hour. And only about 10% are paid less than $10 an hour in Iowa City metro area, which would include Johnson County as a total. But non-metropolitan wages are roughly 20% lower than metropolitan wages. So if you think then what's likely to be true in Iowa City versus some of the smaller towns in the surrounding areas, the minimum wage is probably going to bite more in the non-metropolitan cities than in Iowa City.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to play a little bit of an interview that I did over the summer with a woman named Angela Lamberts of Iowa City. She's worked minimum wage, low-wage positions for many years, now working at ACT for a better wage. But in the past, she worked as a, for instance, a city bus driver in agriculture, other administrative jobs. She was on food stamps twice. She's lived in condemned buildings in Ames. When she first started working, she was getting a $4.25 an hour in fast food. And she relayed in the interview she couldn't even afford a meal where she worked. She recently got married. She says she couldn't survive very well in Iowa City on her own. And she hopes to see the minimum wage go up to $15. So let's listen to a little bit of what she told me back in the summer. When she described how hard it is to make ends meet on a low wage.
During my undergraduate years at Iowa State University, I worked in food service and anywhere I could find a job part-time. I was going to school full-time, and at the time in the 90s, all I could get was minimum wage with no benefits at all. And so I was working up to 25 hours a week because of my schedule. And when I could work 40 hours a week overnights and going to school full time, it was still minimum wage. And I didn't make enough to pay rent and buy food.
So what did you do?
Not very proud to say this. I stole food from my workplaces. I worked in food service, so there was food readily available there. And I didn't eat very much. And when I worked at a grocery store, during the overnights, they had specials on food that was damaged in the morning. The stock people would damage the packaging. And so I would get highly discounted food there. Uh-huh. So that's what I ate.
What are your thoughts when you hear arguments against minimum wage raising? It's, for instance, that employers will then get rid of employees. They'll be more unemployed.
The minimum wage worker generally are the folks that make your food. They take your trash away. They do the basic infrastructure of our culture that we are so comfortable in. And if you take those wages away by not increasing them and then firing people, we're going to lose a whole lot of our basic comforts that we're getting used to. And also, if you fire those people, they won't have access to food or any public assistance because they're making zero. If they have some assistance, it's very limited. And so their sense of self and confidence will degrade.
Okay, that recorded back in the summer with Iowa City resident Angela Lamberts talking about the times she lived on minimum wage. Mary, is that sort of attitude, sentiment, those stories, were they represented in the discussion that you had there in Swisher?
Absolutely. And we heard many of those types of stories. And
so doesn't that give you pause? Doesn't that give you reservations about the business community doesn't want this, but you've got some people who could really use this and are struggling?
And the piece for me that continues to be missing in this type of conversation is the skills to employment. And so what are some things that we can be doing as a city council or as legislatures to make sure that the folks who are trying to make a living off of $7-$8 an hour, what are we doing to better prepare them for some of the jobs that are out there? And there's a lot of them in the area that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
I hear from high-tech manufacturing employers every day where if we can insert some skills into this labor force, there are higher-paying jobs out there. And so I'm saddened that that's a missing piece of the conversation.
Mm. Peter Erasm, do you have anything to say to that or other parts of this conversation?
Well, most of the people who earn the minimum wage are not sole earners for families. Disproportionately, they're single. Disproportionately, they are teenagers or under the age of 25. Very few people earn the minimum wage for their entire career. It's what you get paid when you first start off and you're starting to learn what it's like to be an employee. And so I think a lot of the discussion, related to what the purpose of a job is as sustenance for an entire family is somewhat missing the connection that disproportionately minimum wage workers are not sole earners for households. Some are, but the vast majority are not. About 2% of the population above the age of 25 is paid the minimum wage, and that's of hourly workers. Since half of all workers are salaried and exempt, that's maybe 1% right now of the population above 25 who's being paid the minimum wage. Now, if you raise it up to $10, you're going to be capturing a somewhat larger share of the population. But in Iowa City, that's still going to be a very small fraction of the labor force.
Okay. Very quickly, before we have to go, Peter, tell us, it seems like if Swisher opts out of this, they can pay minimum wage at their fast food places, for instance, and then just down the road, the fast food place, maybe the same chain cannot. Will that have an outflow of workers to outside of Swisher affect the local economy that way?
Well, actually, it could go either way. If the minimum wage bites heavily enough in Iowa City, and over half of minimum wage workers are in food service, and if they're tipped workers in food service, it's going to be a little bit gray as to whether they're affected.
We have just a few seconds, yeah.
Sorry, but you may find that some people will be unemployed in fast food, and maybe they switch to Swisher.
Okay. Peter Erasm, thank you very much. University Professor of Economics at Iowa State University. Mary Gudenkauf, City Council member in Swisher, Iowa. Peter, Mary, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Coming up in just a moment when we continue a week of wildfires in the northwest part of the state. And then we'll talk about those new polls that show Ben Carson leading Donald Trump for the first time in Iowa. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, all the generally dry, windy weather sparked a rash of fires earlier this week in rural Siouxland in northwest Iowa. That is, until we got all this rain starting about midweek. Let's hear about these fires from Lamar's Fire Chief Dave Shipper. Chief Shipper, hello. How are you? What kind of week have you had?
Good, Ben. It's been a tiring couple of weeks, to say the least.
Tell us about the fires you've been fighting.
Well, we've had several around the area, several in Sioux County, in Plymouth County, to emphasize ours in particular. We've been on several mutual aid fires with Alton Fire Department in Sioux County, and then Remsen and Owens Fire Departments in Plymouth County. And then this past Sunday had a very, very large fire of our own that actually took five fire departments and about seven tractors with discs hooked to them and a couple payloaders to control.
Wow, this sounds like something you would get out west, but not in Iowa usually.
Yeah, we've had, as you said before, very, very dry conditions, and some areas were fortunate to get some rain here midweek and even this morning. However, here in Plymouth County and Lamar's especially, we've had the cloudy skies but not a drip of moisture yet. So I'm planning on going out and doing a little rain dance here in a minute. I'm hoping maybe that would help.
I'll do it right along with you. So tell us about the nature of this sort of fire and fighting this sort of fire. What is the character of it?
Well, the tough part with these, Ben, is it's nothing that a burn ban would have helped us with. Most of these have been attributed to harvesting and either being sparked by balers or combines or tractors and that sort of thing. And a lot of times they've gotten into standing corn. And so with the dry conditions and the winds that we've had over in this area recently, we've got some major cornfield fires and the wind just spreading those across those fields as fast as we can chase them sometimes. And so that's where the discs have come in pretty handy to get these things controlled. We're actually just sometimes disking fresh corn ahead of the fire to try to make fire breaks to get it stopped. And fire will create its own wind. So, you know, the other day, Sunday, we had 34 to 40 mile an hour wind gust down in that fire in those areas in those cornfields. I would estimate the winds were probably 80 miles an hour. So very dangerous to area farmers and firefighters who are trying to control these things. And as you said, you know, sometimes we see these things on the news out west, but yeah, we've had our own issues here in Siouxland.
How fast can a fire like this, being propelled by 30, 40-mile-an-hour winds, how fast can it move across a cornfield?
Well, we've had some of our people trying to catch them at 35 miles an hour, and that's pretty fast going across cornfields. We get help sometimes in a field that has terraces because the fire will reach a terrace and then slow down to climb the terrace and then take off when it gets into fresh product again. But they move very, very, very quickly. Our fire we had Sunday, we actually had fire carrying through the air a total of about four city blocks before it was landing. So you can talk about a fire spread where you have two fires burning four city blocks apart from these embers and things being carried through the air in the wind.
That's amazing. Now, is this being tackled, fought with local resources or something greater than that?
Mostly local resources. As I said, Sunday ours, we had five fire departments there with their wildland, urban interface type vehicles, grass pickups and grass rigs, if you will, and then tanker tender trucks for shuttling the water. Of course, we have no fire hydrants out in the rural area, so we have to transport the water. And then the great thing we've had, as we do here in Iowa, is the help of friends and farmers and everybody helping their neighbor where, you know, we have seven people show up with tractors and discs that are risking their equipment and themselves to help us out, and it's not even possibly their field.
So a lot of work side by side with area farmers who are watching their crops and fearing their crops are going up in smoke.
Yeah, and just helping their fellow farmer, their fellow neighbor, and showing up to lend a hand and with valuable pieces of equipment that, you know, in the fire service we don't have. And so when they show up, we try to coordinate with them. We've done as much as use cell phones, give them portable radios in the tractors, and kind of direct them on where we need them to go and what we need them to do. And I'll tell you, it's been a structure saver, a life saver, and a crop property saver for everybody.
It sounds so dangerous, this type of fire. I hope you've avoided injury.
Yeah, so far we have not, in our area with the ones we've had, lost any structures. We have not lost any farming or fire equipment, nor have we injured any firefighters or farmers that have been helping us out. And that's the most important thing we look at, you know, when we're out there fighting those types of fires. Life safety is the first and foremost thing that we want to take care of. And we've been very fortunate because, like I said, the number of fires have been just phenomenal in the last couple, 3 weeks.
What has this meant for your department? You're made up of volunteers, right?
Yeah, we're a combination department, which is full-time and volunteer paid on-call type people. It gets very taxing. And, you know, some of the fears we have, Ben, is, you know, you have five fire departments tied up on one fire. If we were to get another one somewhere, our resources are spread pretty thin.
Right.
As a volunteer services, you know, a lot of members have other jobs. So on a weekend, it's not so bad because a lot of them are off work. But you get during the work week when we've had a few of these, the Monday through Friday, midday, mid-afternoon calls. We've had to call in a lot of other departments around the area just to get the staffing and the equipment that you need, because the normal fire department does not have a full complement due to people having other jobs.
Right. Here at the end of the week, as we mentioned, midweek, a lot of Iowa got some storms, pretty heavy storms, some lightning there that caused some other fires as well. But you say that didn't get your dry conditions remedy you completely in all areas there in the Northwest?
That is correct. We're still waiting for our shot of rain, and forecast has it coming in later yet today, Thursday night and Friday, and we're hoping so, but it doesn't sound like we're going to get a lot. And I'll tell you, you know, I think we could get some substantial rain, Ben, and all it's going to do is settle the dust as dry as it is out there right now.
Okay, thank you very much. Lamar's Fire Chief Dave Shipper, we wish you well there in the northwest part of the state.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Quick conversations to wrap up news in the week. Well, the latest polls of likely Iowa caucus participants by Quinnipiac University show some interesting shifts. Joining us to discuss them, Quinnipiac University Poll Assistant Director Peter Brown, who is in Des Moines. Hello, Peter.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
I'm doing fine. Let's start with the GOP. Dr. Ben Carson leads Trump for the first time.
Right. Dr. Carson, who had been doing quite well in other polls, ours and others, but had never been ahead in Iowa, is now ahead in Iowa, according to the latest Quinnipiac poll, and by a decent margin. The latest poll found that Dr. Carson was getting 28% of the vote among likely caucus goers. Mr. Trump is getting 20%.
Mm-hmm.
Florida Senator Marco Rubio is getting 13%. And the other candidate in double digits is Senator Ted Cruz from Texas, who's getting 10%.
Mm-hmm. Your further polling, does it reveal which demographic groups Dr. Carson is doing better with? What explains this jump ahead of Trump?
The way to look at it is what groups is he outperforming among? In other words, what groups is he doing better in than he's doing overall? Number one is doing very well among women compared to Trump. He has almost a double-digit lead among women. Not quite, but almost there. And so his appeal among caucus goers seems to be more fruitful at this point among women than men. He does very well among those who describe them as white evangelical Christians. Not a surprise that Dr. Carson has made a strong pitch to the faith community around Iowa.
Mm-hmm. You also asked questions about which GOP candidates, likely caucus participants, would definitely not support. Any changes there?
No. Well, Mr. Trump and former Florida Governor Jeb Bush rank high on that list.
Ben Carson is?
Dr. Carson is kind of like the Madison Avenue phrase. Almost no one doesn't like Dr. Carson. His favorable rating is 89% among likely caucus goers. That's a phenomenally high number.
Let's look at the Democratic side. Hillary Clinton, this is in a poll released by Quinnipiac University just today. Hillary Clinton back on top among likely Democratic caucus participants in Iowa.
Right. When Quinnipiac surveyed the previous time in Iowa, which would have been was September 10th, former Secretary Clinton and Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont were essentially tied. One had 41%, one had 40%. And that was a dead heat at that point. And frankly, that was reported on and viewed as very good for Senator Sanders. Senator Sanders has run a grassroots campaign that has been especially active in the early states like Iowa. But now former Secretary Clinton seems to have opened that back up. She had had previous leads before the last one, and she's now has an 11-point lead in this one.
Mm-hmm. And she continues to perform better than Sanders with women.
Right. There is a gigantic gender gap within the Democratic Party. Senator Sanders has a 12-point lead among men, which is ordinarily pretty good and indicates you're in reasonably good shape. But former Secretary Clinton has a 26-point lead among women, likely caucus goers. And so the size of her margin among women voters is really what puts her ahead and makes her tough to defeat.
Mm-hmm. What about the negative list there for the Democrats, GOP candidates that caucus goers would definitely not support?
Lincoln Chafee, but he dropped out this morning.
Right.
Jim Webb, he dropped out a couple of days ago. That there were never getting more than a point or two anyway.
Right. A couple of things I don't imagine were figured into either of these polls because they happened late in the week. We had Senator Biden dropping out. We had the Benghazi testimony yesterday. With Senator Biden dropping out, does more of his support go to Clinton or to Sanders?
Well, actually, it has gone a little bit more to Secretary Clinton because we did ask about Mr. Biden during this week-long survey period. He got out at the very end. So if you have a third candidate in the race, Mr. Biden, he would have gotten 10% of the vote, and he would have reduced former Secretary Clinton's margin by a little bit over what it currently was. It's now at 11 points. I think it would have taken it down to 8 points.
Okay.
But he's now out of the race.
Thank you very much. The latest polls from Quinnipiac University with assistant director of that poll, Peter Brown. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And we're staying with presidential politics for this final segment of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a News Buzz edition, shorter conversations about the news to wrap up the week. Next week, Dort College, you know where that is. It's in Sioux Center in northwest Iowa. Dort College will be presenting its conference on presidential politics. Dort, just a little information about it, has an enrollment of about 1,400 students from 30 states. Founded in 1955, it's associated with the Christian Reformed Church, and according to its website, it welcomes all students who are interested in a biblical, Christ-centered education. Jeff Taylor joins us now. He's chair of the Department of Political Science at Dort College. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ben. Good to be with you.
Great to have you with us. Now, tell us, what are your plans? What's your approach for this conference focusing on presidential politics to be October 29th through the 31st?
Well, Ben, this is we call it an inaugural conference because it's the first of its kind, not only on our campus, but as far as I'm aware, anywhere in the state, where we are focusing on presidential elections and presidential power, and we're bringing scholars across the board, mostly political scientists and historians, which those two groups often do not meet at the same academic conferences. And we're bringing citizens and the media, and we're bringing presidential candidates all together, trying to have this be cross-disciplinary, but also kind of bridging the gap between the theoretical and the practical aspect of presidential politics. And it's going to be running over the course of two or three days. Thursday night we kick off, and then it finishes up on Saturday noon.
Mm-hmm. Now, have you invited all of the candidates from both major parties?
We did, and at the time we were extending the invitations, there were 23 candidates in the race. A few have dropped out since then, and we still hope that there will be maybe a last-minute appearance by one or two additional candidates, but right now we have two candidates committed.
Who's that?
We've got Rick Santorum on the Republican side, who is the defending champion of the Iowa caucuses, at least for the GOP, and then we've got Professor Larry Lessig of Harvard Law School, who is running a campaign focusing on campaign finance reform, and he is running as a Democrat.
Mm-hmm. You may have just heard the Quinnipiac's the conversation I had there about the Quinnipiac poll of likely GOP caucus participants. That poll showing Ben Carson now leading the field. And interestingly, the poll revealing an especially a strong contingency among white evangelical Christians in Iowa. Being that you are a Christian college there, what makes Carson so appealing to evangelical Christians here in Iowa?
I think what brought Carson to the attention of the national public in the first place was his comments at the National Prayer Breakfast a few years back, right, when President Obama was in attendance, and he spoke up strongly in favor of conservative positions on moral issues in terms of abortion and traditional marriage and things like that. And I think just the fact that that's how we first really heard about him, that he was somebody who was, you know, talented and distinguished and somewhat in the public eye, and then he made a splash through that. He seems to be a really perfect fit for the voters who in the past two cycles have supported Governor Huckabee and then Senator Santorum last time. So I think he's inherited a lot of that support.
And you think Ben Carson may be the one for evangelical voters here in Iowa in this election cycle?
He has that. I think he has that appeal, and right now he seems to be in the driver's seat in terms of who is coalescing around him. There's Governor Huckabee has a little bit of support, Senator Santorum a little bit, but they are not catching on like they had in previous years.
When we talk about social issues in these presidential campaigns, you mentioned 2008 to 2012, dealing with social issues. And Ben Carson, for instance, as you said, traditional marriage, a same-sex marriage has gone a huge shift in public attitudes over the past few years. One of the comments that Ben Carson caught a lot of attention for, I think he actually apologized for, was that homosexuality is a choice because, in his words, you go to prison straight, and when they come out, they're gay. Later, he apologized for that comment, but still maintains science is murky on the issue of whether gay is a choice. How do you handle social issues like that in this conference? Are you dedicating time to that, a segment?
There's a little bit. We've got you know, we, as you pointed out, we are a Christian college, liberal arts college. We've got two panels specifically on Christianity and politics, but we have a range of points of view in dealing with that. I mean, we're focusing. One of our keynote speakers is Amy Black from Wheaton College that will be speaking Saturday morning, and she's speaking a little bit more broadly in terms of the impact of religion in presidential contests. But as a predominantly Christian country, in terms of demographics, even though those have changed somewhat in recent years, the Christian aspect is going to come to the forefront, right? But there's a wide variety of different points of view, even here at Dort, but certainly among the attenders of the conference. The majority of the professors and students who will be coming are from non-religious institutions. They're public colleges and universities. So we'll be giving some attention to that, the social issues, but it'll just be one piece of the puzzle we'll look at.
I'm interested in the student body. I named it at about 1,400. You certainly teach classes, I'm sure, in political science. How much debate is there over, let's take traditional marriage, same-sex marriage there? At a Christian college here in Iowa, is there uniformity in the position there, or is that hotly debated?
I wouldn't say it's like a central issue that's debated, but there are still strong feelings kind of across the spectrum here. I'd say most Dort students would say that marriage is, as created by God, is between a man and a woman, but there's even within those who hold to that, there's a range. Sometimes there's a more libertarian element that says, well, this is what we think. And we think this is right. But on the other hand, government shouldn't dictate to everybody. And so, you know, we live in a pluralistic society and you know, that kind of argument. So even within the more conservative side of things of Christianity, there's a range as to how you apply that then in terms of public policy.
Mm-hmm. We have just under a minute left. I wanted to get your comment, Jeff Taylor, on yesterday's testimony by Hillary Clinton, also coupled with the fact that Joe Biden has dropped out, Hillary Clinton doing, by most accounts, very well in that testimony, and then also her debate performance last week. She's swinging up here after a spiral down.
Of course, yeah, that's right. And in politics, it often happens like that, especially for a candidate who is, you know, well known, has a lot of endorsements, has a lot of money in the bank. I assume the pendulum would swing back, and it may be that there's going to be some low spots in the future as well for her. But she's certainly on a roll the past week or week and a half with a strong debate performance. I think she reassured the Democrats with her testimony at the Benghazi hearings, and Biden dropping out, I think, is a gift to her as well. I think that's going to help her a lot.
Before we go, Jeff Taylor, tell us, how do people find out about the conference you're holding next week? Where do they go on the web?
Where they would go on the web, we've got a website that is...
We're running out of time. Just look for Dort College, D-O-R-D-T, right?
The dort.edu, and you can find it off our webpage. Yep, exactly.
Jeff Taylor, thank you very much for the conversation. Chair of Department of Political Science at Dort College in Sioux Center. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we've got to go. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Lindsay Moon, and Claire Roth. Thanks from Sean McClain. Thanks to Sean McClain this hour. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us.